If you got a Bible with you this morning, we are in Genesis chapter 31. We're continuing our series on the life of Jacob. We've been exploring this throughout the summer months. And today we're looking at verses 17 to 55 of Genesis 31. I entitled this message, The Great Escape. I think everyone loves a good escape story, right? We make those escape stories into movies like Escape from Alcatraz or The Shawshank Redemption. Some of the escape stories that we are familiar with are inspiring. Many of us are familiar with the story of the Underground Railroad. That story began with a single individual, Harriet Tubman, who escaped a slave plantation in Maryland in 1849, traveled more than 500 miles to Canada to escape her pursuers, and then actually went back multiple times to help others escape. Some of the escape stories we're familiar with are kind of more of the comical variety, like Toy Story 3. I don't know if you've stopped to think about it, but that was actually an escape story. It was a story of a group of abandoned toys trying to escape from a daycare and a tyrannical teddy bear who kind of oversaw the place. I'm not sure if you ever stopped to think about the fact that the Bible is actually filled with escape stories. When we studied the book of Acts in the fall, we looked at Peter and John's miraculous escape from prison. The Apostle Paul would later have his own prison escape in Acts chapter 16. On another occasion, Paul was placed into a basket and lowered over the wall of the city to escape an angry mob. The Old Testament is filled with escape stories. So there was that one incident. Queen Jezebel issued a decree to have the prophets of the Lord put to death. There were 100 prophets who were rescued by this man named Obadiah, who then hid those 100 prophets in two separate caves. The most famous escape story of all is the story of the Exodus, where God's people had been persecuted. They were enslaved in Egypt, and they escaped with Pharaoh's army fast on their heels. And it just like when it looked like there was no hope for escape, God miraculously intervened. The passage we're looking at today is the story of an escape. It's kind of an underrated escape story, but it is one that we ought to think about along those same lines. And actually, if we think about this story, we will see there's actually lots of parallels between this story and the Exodus story. This story really foreshadows what's going to happen in the Exodus. Well, I'm going to read for you verses 17 to 42, and then we'll take a look at verses 43 to 45 at the end. Let me begin in verse 17. It says, "So Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels. He drove away all his livestock, all his property that he had gained, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household gods. And Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he intended to flee. He fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.' And Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen pitched tents in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, 'What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And now you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?' Jacob answered and said to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. in the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours, and take it. Now Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two female servants, but he did not find them. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." So he searched, but did not find the household gods. Then Jacob became angry and berated Laban. Jacob said to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." Well, I'm going to cover the final section in a separate point, but out of this first section, I want to draw your attention to two things we learn about. And the first one is we learn about the protection of God's people. Now, last week, Andy highlighted the fact that God is faithful to his promises. He will do what he says he will do. You can count on it. A couple of years back, when we looked at the life of Abraham, we entitled that series Between Promise and Fulfillment. And we explored the fact that much of our lives are lived right there. They are lived between the promises of God and the fulfillment of those promises. But sometimes we do get to see the fulfillment of God's promises in our lives. And that is what happens with Jacob here. Look back at verse 3 of this chapter. Here's what it says. "Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you.'" Now, "I will be with you" is the promise of presence. But it signified more than that. So let me take you back to Jacob's first encounter with God in chapter 28. There it says, "Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. I am with you, and I will keep you." That is God's protection. And that is what Jacob experienced here. We shouldn't miss the fulfillment of this promise right here. Now, I said this is an escape story. It begins with Jacob putting a plan together, conferring with his wives, gathering together his flocks, his herds, all of his possessions, and then fleeing while Laban is away at a sheep shearing festival. And Jacob and his crew get at least a 3-day head start. Everything seems to be going according to plan. They cross the Euphrates River, but then Laban starts the pursuit. And we don't know exactly what his intentions were when he was to catch up with Jacob. We know they're not good. The language used throughout this part of the account is actually military language, right? Laban and his cronies pursued Jacob. They overtake him. They talk about the sword. And when it says in verse 25 that Jacob pitched his tent and that Laban pitched his tents, it doesn't use the normal Hebrew word or phrase for that activity. That phrase actually comes up a number of times in Genesis. So back in chapter 12, it talks about Abraham pitching his tents. Later, it'll talk about Isaac pitching his tents. And again, later in Jacob's life, it's going to talk about him pitching his tents. Now, that's kind of the normal way that's described. But in this instance, it actually uses a different Hebrew word together. And this word is a military word. It's for sort of setting up a military encampment. That's the kind of hostility that existed between Laban and Jacob. And if we're reading this for the very first time, I mean, we would have to know that the numbers, the resources, all of that rested with Laban. But notice what God does. Look again at verse 24. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." Now, if they were to engage in a military battle, Laban would win. But God intervened. God protected. And if we were to paraphrase verse 24, we might say that God appeared to Laban in a dream and said, "Laban, you better check yourself before you wreck yourself." Right? That's really what he's saying. Look, you better consider the consequences of what you're about to do, because if you do anything to harm Jacob, it is not going to go well for you. God intervenes on behalf of his people. He protects his people. This is not the first time we've encountered something like this. Back in chapter 20, Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, came to the region of Gerar. And he was fearful when he entered that place that the men of the place would kill him and take his wife. So he pretended that Sarah was his sister, not his wife. And here's what it says. And Abram said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself said, 'He is my brother'? In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." That is God's protection. And as with the case of Laban, the protection ran in two directions. I mean, Abraham and Sarah were protected from Abimelech, but Abimelech was also protected from himself. And you see that same thing in our passage. Jacob and Leah and Rachel were protected from Laban, but Laban was protected from himself. And he seemed to take that warning to heart. Verse 29 says this, "It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, 'Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad.'" Laban got the point that God protects his people. And he does. This doesn't mean we will never endure hardships. It doesn't mean we won't experience persecution. It does mean that God cares for and protects his people. Now, what we read here is a specific promise to a specific person, right? It's directed towards Jacob. But there is actually a New Testament equivalent for the church. There's a promise for the church. Listen to what Paul says to the church in Corinth. He says, "Do you not know that you plural, are God's temple, and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you, plural, are that temple." Now, I think it's important to bear this in mind, to remember God's promise to the church. Sometimes we can do a lot of hand-wringing about those who seek to destroy the church, whether it's from the outside and persecution that might come, or whether it's from the inside and false teaching that might arise. And we ought to be vigilant about those things. But we also need to remember that our ultimate protection is from God himself, his promise. He will protect his church. The church is the bride of Christ, and Jesus will protect his bride. God protects his people. The second thing we learn about here is the worthlessness of idols. This is actually a really interesting part of the story. Verse 19 tells us that Rachel stole her father's household idols. So after Laban catches up to Jacob, he makes an impassioned speech. He tells Jacob, look, you know, you shouldn't have left in such a hurry because, you know, I would have liked to give you a proper send-off with a feast and special music and all of that. That's what Laban would have done, right? Well, we know that's not true. But then right at the end of that speech, he asks this question. But why did you steal my gods? And just as a side note, if your gods can be stolen from you, they're not really gods. Actually, that is the point that's being driven home here. I mean, we get a very descriptive summary of what happened. Jacob doesn't know anything about the fact that Rachel has stolen these household idols, so he tells Laban to conduct a search. And Laban goes through the tents one by one, doesn't find anything. But then he enters the tent of Rachel. And listen again to verses 34 and 35. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban felt about the tent but did not find them. And she said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me. So he searched but did not find the household gods. Now you might wonder why I felt the need to read that again. Or you might wonder why that detail needed to be included in the story at all. I mean, don't forget to write down that part about Rachel hiding these gods by sitting on them and saying she's having her period. Why is that here? Well, I think it's here to help us to remind us that idols need to be put in their proper place. Now, Laban valued these idols. He seems more concerned about them than he does about his daughters. Maybe they were made of precious metal. Maybe they represented security. But the Bible's verdict on them is that they're completely worthless. They ought to be esteemed the way Rachel esteemed them, sat on them. Now, I know that in our day we are super sensitive about ever saying anything like that, but the Bible is not bashful in the least when it comes to making fun of the things people worship and putting them in their place. 1 Kings 18 is a familiar story. It's the story of the prophet Elijah in a showdown of sorts with the prophets of Baal. The parameters were that each group would prepare an altar, or prepare a sacrifice, and that the God who answered by fire was the true God. Here's how it played out. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first. For you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it, and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. And no one answered because there was no God to answer. And that kind of mockery is not an isolated incident. Listen to this description from Isaiah. He says, the ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man, with the beauty of a man, to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar, and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the other half, he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, "Aha, I am warm. I've seen the fire." And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." And Isaiah's point is, look, they go to all of this great trouble to make these idols. And it is complete foolishness. Bow down to them all you want. They cannot deliver you. It is utter foolishness to trust in things that cannot deliver us. And I know we can read that and say, well, that's ancient history. You know, of course they thought like that back then. We've advanced so much beyond that. I don't think we have. So I had to drive into Vancouver last Saturday afternoon. And I will, you know, when I have a longer drive to do, I will often listen to something, you know, educational, like podcasts or books or country music. But on this Saturday, the Mariners were playing an afternoon game, and I'm a glutton for punishment when it comes to the Mariners, so I was listening to the pregame show. They were playing a series against the Blue Jays, one of my least favorite teams in all of professional sports. In any case, the Mariners, they've been in a pretty major slump lately, but they had won two games in a row. And one of the play-by-play guys made the comment that the Mariners are 7-0 when wearing their City Connect jerseys, kind of like a retro throwback jersey. Maybe that's why they won. This led to a roundtable discussion about athletes and superstitions. And one of the play-by-play guys said, "Well, I'm doing my part." He said, two nights ago on my way into the ballpark, I decided I was going to play the same song on a loop for my entire commute. It was like a Fleetwood Mac song. Listened to it for his 20-minute commute. They won. So he said, "You know, I did the same thing the next day." And then he said on this day, on this Saturday, his commitment to that was really put to the test because there was a major construction thing happening and his 20-minute commute changed to a 1 hour and 20 commute. But he was resolute in his commitment. He listened to that same Fleetwood Mac song for an hour and 20 minutes. And the Mariners went on to lose that game, of course. Not only did his superstition not help him, but he had to listen to the same Fleetwood Mac song for an hour and 20 minutes. I mean, do you know how stupid that is? To think that makes any, to drive around in your car thinking that makes some kind of difference to the outcome of a baseball game? Now, I know someone might say, "Hey, what's the harm in that? I mean, it's just, you know, a little superstition." Or maybe they might say, "You know, I'm not superstitious, I'm just a little stitious." But here's the thing about idols. Putting your trust in an idol is not a harmless thing. Beliefs have consequences. The psalmist put it like this. He said, "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat." And then he says, "Those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them." See, idolatry is not a harmless thing. Putting your trust, your hope, your security in anything that is not God will lead to your own destruction. Now, before we leave this issue of idolatry, I think it's worth exploring one other part of it. Laban's question to Jacob was, "Why did you steal my gods?" Now, we know from reading the story that the person who should have been asked that question was Rachel. Rachel, why did you steal the gods? Now, it could have been because they were of great monetary value. It could have been because she wanted to make her dad suffer. She knew how much he loved them. She wanted to hit him where it would hurt the most. I think the real reason, though, is because she hasn't completely left her paganism behind. If these idols provided any kind of security, why wouldn't she take them? I mean, at this point, it seems like she is still thinking, look, maybe it's just good to cover all the bases. I mean, maybe Jacob's God is all that, but just in case, I'm going to take the idols along. Now, if you know the rest of the Old Testament story, you will know that the worship of idols and foreign gods is going to be a continual snare and stumbling block for the people of Israel. They're going to need to be told repeatedly to put away their foreign gods. And you know, lots of people live like this. They practice what I would call Andianity. Now, I don't mean that they worship Andy, but that they worship lots of ands. Actually, I'm just updating the language of C.S. Lewis with that description. In his book, The Screwtape Letters, Uncle Screwtape writes a letter to his nephew, Wormwood, and says this: "The real trouble about the set of your patient is living is that it is merely Christianity. What we want, if men become Christians at all, is to keep them in the state of mind I call Christianity and." You know, Christianity and the crisis. Christianity and the new psychology. Christianity and the new order. Christianity and faith healing. Christianity and physical research. Christianity and vegetarianism. Christianity and spelling reform. If they must be Christians, let them at least be Christians with a difference. Substitute for faith itself some fashion with a Christian coloring. Now, I don't know all that was going on in C.S. Lewis's day, that spelling reform was a big thing. But let me just ask you this question. What is your and? I mean, what is that thing that you put to the right of your simple trust in Jesus? What is the idol, or what are the idols that you are tempted to cling to? To look to for your security or your identity. It could be your wealth. It could be your health. It could be a sense of control. It could be a relationship. It could be anything where you, like Rachel, think, I'm going to hang on to this just in case. So we recently updated our baptism class, and one of the things we added to that process was a personal spiritual inventory. So we have people think through their associations with other religions or occult activity or New Age practices, and we want people to understand that following Jesus means getting rid of whatever they used to worship. That's what we need to do. Now, throughout this series, we've been saying that there's an observable growth in the life of Jacob. He is a crooked stick, but God does start to shape him or straighten him out. And I want to show you that growth by just looking back in this chapter. Look at what Jacob says to Rachel and Leah in verse 5. He says there, "I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before. but the God of my father has been with me. So for 20 years, Jacob has served Laban, but now he can see the futility of trusting in this man. Listen now to the end of his speech to Laban in verses 41 and 42. He says, "These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." So it's been a hard lesson, but Jacob has learned not to trust in man, not to trust in any earthly security, but to place his trust and his confidence in God, and God alone. God is the one who has provided. God is the one who has protected. And we need to come to that same realization. We need to understand that there is nothing on earth that can give us the kind of security we are looking for. All the idols we're tempted to trust in are completely worthless. Well, there's one more section to go here, and I'm going to read it for you and then just draw your attention to one thing. So I want you to listen now to verses 43 to 55, the end of the chapter. It says, "Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, 'The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these my daughters, or for their children whom they have borne? Come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me.' So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, 'Gather stones.' And they took stones and they made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jegur Sahudatha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, 'This heap is a witness between you and me today.' Therefore he named it Galeed and Mizpah, for he said, 'The Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters, or if you take wives beside my daughters, although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me.' Then Laban said to Jacob, 'See this heap and the pillar which I have set between you and me? This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us.' So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and Jacob offered a sacrifice in the hill country and called his kinsmen to eat bread. They ate bread and spent the night in the hill country. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned home." And what we learn about here in this section is two divergent paths. So this is where Jacob and Laban part company. They go their separate ways. And what are we supposed to make of this scene? Well, some have seen in it a sort of wonderful exchange between Laban and Jacob. The King James Version translated Laban's words in verse 49 like this: "And Mizpah, for he said, 'The Lord watch between me and thee when we are absent from one another.' And this came to be known as the Mizpah blessing. The verse sometimes appears in greeting cards and the like to invoke a sense of union and fellowship and trust. It's a really nice sentiment, but I don't think that's actually what's going on here. This is more of a non-aggression pact. Now, I don't know if you ever shared a room with a sibling. I did when I was younger for a time, and there were several occasions in which we basically put a line down the middle of the room. You know, this is my side. I don't want you crossing over. That's your side, and I won't cross over. Okay, maybe your kids have done that in the back of the minivan, right? I know they have. Or you've told them to. That's what's happening here. Notice the way the story is told. There are two of everything here. There are two meals. There are two stone monuments. Two different names for them, right? One Hebrew, one Aramaic. And there is the invocation of two different gods. look at verse 53 again. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. Now, when we read that, we think, well, this is all just a description of God. I don't want to harp on Bible translators, but I think the verse should really be translated like this. The God, capital G of Abraham, the God, small g of Nahor, the gods, small g of their fathers, judge between us. See, people sometimes forget that Abraham was a pagan when he was first called. And here's how Joshua described his family. Joshua said unto all the people, "Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods." That's actually, Laban is still caught up in all of that. And when he's invoking God, he's not thinking of Yahweh, the God of Israel. The point I'm trying to highlight is that this parting of ways was what was best for all involved. See, sometimes the thing that you need to do most is to cut ties with the idols that you are tempted to cling to. And sometimes the thing that you need to do most is to cut ties with the relationships that are toxic and destructive. Now, I know Christians often deal with a lot of guilt about that sort of thing. I mean, we're supposed to be forgiving people after all. And of course, there is a place for that. There's a call to that. But you can extend forgiveness and still not necessarily be in a close relationship with someone or trust them the way you once did. I mean, the New Testament also gives us this clear instruction: do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Jacob needed to part company with Laban. Now, this is not a license to walk away from a relationship simply because there's conflict or difference of opinion, but there are times when that's the best course of action. I thought these words from Gary Thomas were helpful. He said, "I used to think if I can just become a little holier, a little wiser, more loving, a little more patient, a bit more knowledgeable about the Bible, more surrendered to the Holy Spirit, etc., then everyone will see Jesus in me and line up to hear what God has to say. When someone didn't respond or became hostile, I thought, is there some compromise in my life holding me back? Are my words lacking grace?" And he said he thought that way until a friend of his made a comment along the lines of, "Well, you know, you should read the Gospel of Luke, because you will see that Jesus walked away from numerous people." Now, I want to be careful here, because relationships are hard work. And not every difficulty in a relationship should be seen as a license to walk away, but there are times where, as Jesus tells us, we need to shake the dust off our feet. There are times we need to part company and move on. Now again, Jacob had a clear word. You're to return to your homeland. And if the relationship is the thing that's in the way of us following Jesus, that might be a tie you need to cut or break or sever. So sometimes the thing we need to cut ties with is the idols that try to trap us, and sometimes it's with the relationships that bring us down. Let me just pray for God's grace in all of our lives. Father, we pray that you'd give us wisdom to simply know how to navigate life in this world. Lord, if we're honest, sometimes we're tempted by lots of things, tempted to trust in lots of different things. Sometimes we're tempted to trust in relationships or just maintain them because we think it's the easiest course of action, and sometimes it's the thing that brings us down. And so, Lord, I pray for your wisdom for those who are here. Pray for your grace that we might handle all things well. And Lord, we just pray as a church that we would be faithful to you in all things. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.